Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Reclaimed, the podcast you're listening to. My name is William DeBiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. And once again, as we so often do on this Critically Reclaimed podcast, we're taking a trip back to the 90s, briefly lay out the premise of the show.
Okay.
There is a whole slew of things to choose from when it comes to all of the streaming services. Over the last year and a half during the pandemic, more people have been spending time inside with their streaming services, and we decided to explore a bit.
Yeah, and of course, the stuff that's making all the headlines are the new movies, the new TV shows, the big, you know, the big... the ones that are trending on your various social media services.
If it's an older film, it's a film that is really well-liked already and has a big following already.
So yeah. But the thing
is, the Lord of the Rings movies are coming to blank. It's like, well, we know that. We've seen them.
But these streaming services have these big, giant back catalogs that sometimes aren't explored. And this gives us an opportunity to not only share some of those older films with you, but also to shore up some holes in our own film education. Whitney Seibold and I have been film critics, professional film critics, like full-time film critics for about 10 years now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're only human and we haven't seen every single thing. So every single film that we cover on Critically Reclaimed is a movie that at least one of us has either never seen or hasn't seen in so very long that we might as well have never seen it.
Right.
And what we do is every week we pick a streaming service. We pick a particular category. Maybe it's a genre. Maybe it's a decade. We pick four films, two films each. We put them on our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. There's a poll. Only our patrons get to vote for that poll. And they get to decide what we're going to review every single week. And this week, we decided to head on over to Disney Plus and look at some, I believe the topic was live action films from the 90s.
Yeah. Disney Plus, as we had a whole podcast devoted to films that weren't on Disney Plus. And it's frustrating because Disney Plus was created specifically to display this gigantic catalog of films that Disney had recently acquired. They bought Fox.
Yeah.
All of a sudden they have thousands and thousands of movies, and then they're going to launch their streaming service. And you would think, as a film aficionado and a fan of archiving and such things, that they would put everything.
Yep.
Thousands of movies all at once. No, they released it with, 250 titles?
It was a few hundred, and to be fair, I will say this for Disney. And this is only in America. People's access to Disney's catalog varies from country to country. But speaking in America, Disney has the Disney Plus streaming service, which launched a couple of years ago, but they also, when they purchased Fox, they acquired Hulu.
That's right. So they kind of have two.
So the idea, my understanding, was like all of like the sort of family-friendly stuff would be on Disney Plus. Mm. That's their brand. It's going to be branded with Disney. And everything else would go to Hulu.
Right.
Which actually makes perfectly fine sense to me. You know, like, what are we really... Does Die Hard really belong on Disney Plus? Feels a little harsh, doesn't it?
Disney is the name of the company. You know, I'm not concerned with their brand. I don't care. Are. I know they are. I don't care.
I appreciate that. I'm just trying to explain how this works. But regardless, yeah, there's still these like gigantic holes in their catalog that have either that have not shown up on these streaming services, either because Disney doesn't give a shit, Disney doesn't remember it, maybe they're in really bad shape and need to get cleaned up and they haven't gotten around to it because there's not a lot of demand. There's a million different reasons. Sometimes they're just ashamed of it. Sometimes they just put out some racist crap, and that's totally a thing we've discovered on our podcast.
Dinosaurs is missing.
One of our dinosaurs is missing is not on Disney Plus for very good reasons. Holy shit, that movie.
Cute concept,
yes.
Racist execution.
Really racist execution. So, however, there's still a lot of stuff on Disney Plus. We can't deny it, and there's plenty of stuff that one or both of us hasn't seen. And the winner of our poll was a movie that I had seen. Whitney's getting his first true experience with it. And that is the 1993 all-star Disney adaptation of Alexandre Dumas' The Three Musketeers.
Walt Disney Pictures presents the story of the greatest heroes who ever lived.
Long live the Musketeers!
It was a time when danger was irresistible.
Did I miss anyone?
King's life is in danger. We have work to do.
1,000 gold pieces on each of their heads, dead or alive.
I prefer...
Kill him!
Dead.
Adventure was everywhere.
I hope we're not interrupting.
Kill those musketeers.
Champagne?
We're in the middle of a chase, Porthos.
And friendship.
You're right. Something red.
Was the greatest weapon of all.
The Three Musketeers stars Bryan Adams and Rod Stewart and Sting as the Three Musketeers.
Oh my god, I would have killed to have seen that version.
No, my knowledge of this 1993 version of Three Musketeers was the hit song that went along with it. And yeah. The Three Musketeers was clearly, very clearly made to piggyback on the success of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which came out just a few years before.
It's actually, I want to talk about this because I think it's half that.
Okay.
And half Young Guns.
Okay.
So what happened was in the late 80s, early 90s, there was the action genre was in some interesting places, and they had decided to do a cowboy movie starring a lot of the hot young stars of the era. It was Kiefer Sutherland, yeah. Charlie Sheen, Emilio Estevez.
Lou Diamond Phillips.
Lou Diamond Phillips, those are the big ones. But other people as well, Dermot Mulroney, I think, was in the second one. There's a bunch. And the idea was, everyone's hunky and cool, we're going to put them in leather, and we're going to put some awesome, badass soundtrack in it, and it's going to be incredibly historically inaccurate, have nothing whatsoever to fucking do with it, and it's going to be fun.
The movie is cast-based. You don't really need a story in there.
And there really isn't much of one.
All you need is...
They're just cool and cowboys.
Glory shots of the hot young hunks in their cowboy outfits doing sexy things. I don't know if the film... I know there's a sequel, Young Guns 2, and there was another one called Bad Girls, and I don't know if that's not a spinoff at all.
Just tonally similar.
So, okay.
Because that one had, what did that have? That had Madeline Stowe and
Andy McDowell.
And Drew Barrymore.
They were the Bad Girls.
I haven't seen that since theaters. I have no memory of how that goes.
I haven't seen Bad Girls or Young Guns, but...
You haven't seen Young Guns ever?
Nope, not ever.
It's fun.
I mean, I was not interested in Westerns, and I didn't see Young Guns, I didn't see Wyatt Earp or Tombstone or any of those. It took me a long time to catch up to Unforgiven. Those were the hot young stars at the time, the Brat Pack, or Brat Pack adjacent actors.
Yeah.
And also... And Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves showed that these sort of sweeping romantic adventure films could make big money.
And not only that, I feel like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves is, I don't want to say underrated, because whether you like it or not, and there's stuff to like about it, stuff to not like about it in equal measure, that's irrelevant. I think we underestimate how significant that movie is.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of how influential the movie Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves is. It might not realize that if you're younger and you weren't around when it came out, you might not realize that movie was like the highest grossing film of that year.
Yeah.
That movie was huge.
It was a juggernaut. And it became a slumber party standard. Kids would gather together and watch it in huge numbers.
Yep.
Kevin Costner was this gigantic sex symbol at the time. There's a scene where he shows his butt. From what I understand, it was a butt double.
It was a butt double, yeah. It was another one that had a hit soundtrack from Bryan Adams. The theme song to that one was just another one that was everywhere.
Alan Rickman plays the bad guy, is sort of another notable American role for him.
What I see connecting this Young Guns, and also I will say this, the other thing about Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves is that the story structure for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, it's Batman Begins. You ever actually watch them back to back? It's the same fucking movie.
They pretty much ripped off the story. They just did the Robin Hood story with Batman.
Yeah. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves opens with the asshole son of a rich guy who never really appreciated what he had going off to different parts of the world. He's in prison. He has learned how to fight and become a great warrior. He returns back to his home, which it turns out has been taken over by assholes, and now he's got to become a vigilante in order to fight them. A vigilante whose partner is a tech expert played by Morgan Freeman. They just got Morgan Freeman again. They weren't even hiding that. There's the girl that he loved thinks he's an asshole and doesn't trust him to be responsible, so she doesn't believe that he's actually this heroic vigilante guy, and it's the exact same fucking thing as the Katie Holmes. It's the same fucking movie.
It's like the analogs are really, really solidly there. And it was so successful, it was referenced in all other media.
Yeah.
Mel Brooks made a movie lampooning it.
Mostly
Robin Hood,
a little
Men in
bit
Tights.
Of Errol Flynn, mostly Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
There's even a joke in Robin Hood, Men in Tights, the Mel Brooks film, where Robin Hood, who's played by Cary Elwes in that movie, is sort of has appeared in front of the king, and he's King John, who's taken over the throne. And he's King John says, "Why should I take you seriously?" He says, "Unlike some other Robin Hoods, I can speak with an English accent."
Yeah.
Which is a direct dig at Kevin Costner, who sounds like he's from Southern California.
Yeah, I think the original idea was he wasn't good at the accent, and they were going to dub him later, and then they decided not to bother. Yeah. So
I'm Robin Hood.
Kevin Costner does all of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Eddie Izzard has a bit. It's like, where is the Maid Marian and the Sheriff of Nottingham?
Yeah, he plays all of Robin Hood as an American. Hmm. And I think that's also significant, because what Young Guns and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves and Three Musketeers did as well was
Americanize it.
Well, I mean, Young Guns was American as well, but they're trying to make everything modern and American.
Hmm.
You know, fucking Young Guns had, like, John Bon Jovi on the fucking soundtrack. At least the sequel did. We had, and Robin Hood is now the American who comes to England in order to fix their shit. And Three Musketeers, it's actually weird how there's this trope in movies where it's set in a country where people don't speak English, but because it's an American production or British production, all the characters do. And we're just supposed to have it understood that they're really speaking French or they're really speaking German.
It's been
and
really
they're just translated, and we're supposed to accept that.
They're translated. It's okay. And they might still have their original names.
Yeah. Henri.
My name is Henri. And that's true in The Three Musketeers when Chris O'Donnell shows up, free from UC Santa Cruz.
Like, says, hey, I'm D'Artagnan.
What's your name? I'm D'Artagnan. You're Chad and you know it. So it takes place in France, and they talk about the French throne, but everybody's speaking English.
Everybody's English. Everybody's American except for Tim Curry, who's British, but he's the bad guy. So okay,
I'm Cardinal Richelieu.
Yeah, and but then like 30 minutes into the movie or whatever, you run into a young Julie Delpy, who's only in like two
scenes.
Actual
French actress,
and she's speaking with a French accent, and you're like, okay, whoa, you just broke my mind. What accent is everyone else speaking in?
I got used to that because 2 years before this, a movie came out called Beauty and the Beast, which also took place in France.
Oh, yeah.
And only one character, two or three characters had French accents, and the rest were American or British.
It was just Cogsworth and Lumiere, right?
Cogsworth was British.
Oh, right, Cogsworth was British, but Lumiere
played by Jerry Orbach, had a French accent.
Jerry Orbach.
It
blew my mind when I found out that Jerry Orbach was Lumiere.
The cop from Law and Order was Lumiere.
Because he has such a particular, presence, and he comes across as just an older American man, and to find out he actually did a pretty damn good French character in a Disney animated movie, I never would have noticed. Usually, when they cast celelities to play like animated characters, now they don't want them to hide their voice.
Yeah, they want the celebrity voice.
Yeah,
A dubious. It's not one I really am fully in favor of. No. I think there's a whole spate of professional voice actors who can do that, that are losing jobs to people who aren't professional voice actors or are just doing it for the first time. Shrek really kicked that door open.
Aladdin started it, but
Robin Williams didn't want it to happen. And there's this whole story about how Robin Williams objected to the way they used his name in the advertising when he didn't want them to. Anyway, we're off topic.
But back to the
Three Musketeers, all these Southern Californians in France, and they're doing Dumas' novel.
Yeah. It's directed by Stephen Herrick.
Yay!
Fun director! Stephen Herrick
of Critters fame.
He had done Critters, which is awesome. He had done Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which is awesome. He had done Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, which became a cult classic.
It's a cult classic.
People like them. I like that movie a lot. I watched it a bunch of times growing up. I quote it all the time. I'm right on top of that, Rose. He did The Mighty Ducks the year prior, which was a huge hit for Disney.
Yeah.
Huge. And he finished out the 90s, pretty solid. He did Mr. Holland's Opus, Academy Award-nominated drama. He did 101 Dalmatians, which that first live action one with Glenn Close, pretty good.
Okay.
It's actually, I rewatched it recently. It holds up better than I thought.
It's not just a good Glenn Close performance. It's actually
mostly a good Glenn Close performance, but it works. Okay. It's a family movie and it works. Yeah. I'm not going to complain about it.
How does it compare to Cruella?
Oh, it's better. both of the other live action 101 Dalmatians are better than Cruella, I think. Yeah. But then after that, you know, he had a couple of semi-successful movies. He did that Mark Wahlberg movie, Rockstar.
He did a Holy Man, which was sort of the downturn for him.
Yeah, right? that was not a hit.
It was not a hit.
It was around the time Eddie Murphy was starting to make hit movies again, and for whatever reason, Holy Man didn't work.
Just didn't catch
on. I just never saw that one, so I can't speak to it.
I saw the preview 1,000 times because it played at the movie theater where I was working.
Did you ever see the Angelina Jolie movie he did, Life or something like it?
I didn't see that one either.
Okay, this movie pisses me off, and I'll tell you, I want to cover this digression.
Is it the distorted voice scene that pisses you off?
No. What? No.
There's a scene in the movie where Angelina Jolie is giving a live broadcast, and somebody in the tech booth is trying to sabotage her broadcast, so they distort her voice.
Oh.
Speaking to the, and she starts to sound like a chipmunk.
I don't remember that at all.
But the weird thing is, she's on mic, live on the scene, and coming through the speakers, like on the TVs at home, she sounds like a chipmunk. But live on the scene, people are laughing at her voice.
They would have no idea.
Yeah, there's,
that part I don't remember. What I do remember is the idea of Life or Something Like It is that Angelina Jolie, who plays an extremely platinum blonde reporter and who only cares about superficial things, she cares about her career, how she looks, she is doing an on-air interview with a famous street performer who can allegedly see the future. Mm. And so she says, okay, well, what, and she's got like a big like interview coming up for like a huge job. And she's super excited. It's like, okay, so what's going to happen to me next week? Ha ha ha. And he's like, you're going to die. And she's like, what? He's like, oh, yeah, you're going to die.
That's right, that's the premise.
The premise is she's going to die. And so now she's going to change her whole life around, and her camera guy, played by Ed Burns, is going to fall in love with her when she starts living her life. And I swear to God, I didn't see that movie for years because I saw the trailer. I'm like, I see what they're doing here. She's going to dye her hair. And because she changed her look, she's not going to get that job.
You're going to die? That was the joke?
I assumed that was the joke.
All right.
And it turns out, no, she actually dies.
oh, great. Okay.
She dies and comes back, you know? Like, she dies for like bizarre. A minute, okay. And they, you know, paddle her, you know, with the shock paddles? What do you call it? The defibrillator.
defibrillator,
and she's fine. But, like, spoilers for a movie you were never going to see. You were never... If anyone in our audience was like, God, I was waiting for the right time to watch Life or Something Like It, I sincerely apologize. My point is this, my ending's better.
Yeah.
It's not good either way, but I gave it like the Preston Sturges ending, and they just gave it this like crappy early 90s comedy ending. It doesn't work. But anyway, Stephen Herrick, underrated filmmaker. He, when you look at his early credits and you realize, Jesus, he made a lot of hit films.
Well, or cult films.
Well, hits, I think. I mean, you look at, again...
Bill and Ted was...
Critters was modest, but it was a success.
Hmm.
Okay, you've got Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which was actually like delayed on the schedule for a long time because they thought no one would like it. Hmm. Runaway success.
Yeah.
Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, eventually now considered a success. The Mighty Ducks, gigantic smash hit.
At the time.
At the time. Three Musketeers, very successful. Not gigantic, but very successful. Mr. Holland's Opus, acclaimed film.
Yeah.
101 Dalmatians, gigantic hit. That's a great decade for any filmmaker. So here's Stephen Herrick at the height of his game, and he has assembled the following pretty damn good cast for the time. You got to admit that like this looks good on a poster. So you've got Kiefer Sutherland as Athos, the moody musketeer. You've got Charlie Sheen as Aramis, the sexy priest musketeer. You've got Oliver Platt as Porthos, the funny musketeer, who, I am pleased to report, has more sexual energy than anyone else in this movie, with the possible exception of the villain, Cardinal Richelieu, played by Tim Curry, who seriously should have an honorary Oscar by now.
He's going to get some sort of lifetime achievement award at some point, especially with like dudes our age sort of on those voting bodies now.
When you consider how many iconic roles he played and how many movies he made dramatically better just by showing up that day. And he's great in this. He's so much fun. He's having a blast.
He's a good villain. And Milady, the mysterious Milady, is played by Rebecca de Mornay.
Yes. Also a great get.
And and so she's sex symbol of the time.
Yep. We've also got, as Captain Rochefort, a part, Cardinal Richelieu can't really sword fight our heroes. That's not the type of guy he is, so he needs... So he has a guy with one eye who's evil. This is a part that had previously been played by the likes of like Christopher Lee. Here he's played by Michael Wincott, playing the same character he played in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. He's got an eye patch and he's French now. Same guy. If you don't know Michael Wincott, he was the main bad guy in The Crow. He has one of the great movie voices. My God. this boy tried to hunt the sheriff of Nottingham's dead
swordfish. Three Musketeers is to Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, as Dick Tracy is to Batman.
Oh, definitely.
There's your SAT analogy.
Yeah. It definitely owes a lot to Young Guns for its, like, all-star casting trick, but this is Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
They rip off a lot. They use a lot of the same talents. Mm-hmm. It's made in the same kind of...
The whole rescue people idea. When they're about to be executed in public scene, that's there, too.
However, the difference is Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves is a very elaborate production. It's large and lavish, and they shot outdoors on location and kind of misty British locales. The Three Musketeers is a much cheaper production, and it kind of shows. It's actually really interesting to watch what adventure films looked like in the early 90s compared to now, because they are so much less elaborate now.
Yeah.
There's just like less cutting. The stunts are a lot less elaborate. They're, they have like Chris O'Donnell doing some of his own stuff.
Yeah.
There's a bit where in the beginning, D'Artagnan he's a little bit of a ne'er-do-well, and he's fleeing a bad guy whose sister he has dishonored.
The bad guy, by the way, is played by Paul McGann, who you might recall as the American Doctor Who. He wasn't ever American, but like there was that brief period where they were going to reboot Doctor Who as an American TV series. They made a pilot.
There's a pilot.
They turned into a TV movie, but it's canon. So Paul McGann is one of the official doctors, and he did a lot of radio shows. So if you're a Doctor Who fan, you're probably familiar with Paul McGann.
Yeah.
He's a fun actor. He's also playing a character who is coded very queer and is not treated well.
He's a foolish fop is sort of the archetype. Mm-hmm. And one of the opening scenes is Chris O'Donnell fleeing from this guy in creative ways with a smirk on his face. And there's a bit where he's, I'm not even sure what it is, like some sort of grain mill that he grabs onto this big yard arm and swings around in a gigantic circle. And that, I'm pretty sure that was Chris O'Donnell actually doing that.
That was
in 1993, a pretty big stunt.
Yeah. It's a pretty good stunt, actually.
You fast forward to something like the Pirates of the Caribbean, and they're doing sword fights on rolling wagon wheels that are rolling down a hill. It's what with the CG, then they can start blending all these shots together.
Everything's so
it
huge.
It seems so lo-fi now.
Everything's so huge in those movies that nothing makes an impact. Yeah. And I actually like the way the action shot in this movie. It's clean. You can always tell what's going on. Every once in a while, you can tell that, like, Charlie Sheen had a stunt double. But for the most part, people are doing the real work. The camera is far back enough that you can actually just appreciate the fencing. Mm. There's a stunt at the beginning that made me laugh because Chris O'Donnell is running from Paul McGann. Mm. And he's running down this path in the forest. And on the path, there's a fallen tree. And the tree has fallen at, like, the height that would, like, knock off Chris O'Donnell's head if he wasn't paying attention. Mm. And what he does is he jumps onto that and, like, walks on it and gets back on his horse. It's a fun, elaborate stunt. But there's a weird thing there. The tree has been there for so long that there's actually grass and flowers growing on it. It looks really, really pretty. But it's also in the middle of the road where people are riding on horseback. So literally everyone... like going down this path is going to hate this fucking tree, and they would have chopped it down by now.
Well, it wasn't a tree.
It wasn't a tree.
It was a tunnel. It was like wide and flat. It wasn't just a tree. That's why it was dirt. It was like a path. They had clearly like bore a hole through something. Somebody dug a hole.
But why would they do it badly? Why would they do it in such a way that would knock your head off if you were on a horse?
Clearly it was made long before they were riding horses through that area. They were just walking on foot. I think it made perfect sense to me.
I don't buy it. It's a little thing, but I don't buy it.
But Chris O'Donnell leaps off of his horse, runs across the top of this little abutment, and lands back on his horse as it runs out from the exit. And
fun little stunt.
Paul McGann tries to do it, and the horse stops, and he falls off, and it's... what a pratfall.
What a wacky guy. Chris O'Donnell's whole thing is he is leaving home in his small town to become a musketeer, because his father was a musketeer. And what is a musketeer, you might ask?
Well,
a musketeer is the king's royal guard. It is an entire small personal army dedicated specifically to making sure nobody kills him. And when we cut to the royal palace, we find out that Cardinal Richelieu, who is evil because he's played by Tim Curry, has decided to disband the musketeers, ostensibly because there's an oncoming war with England and they need the musketeers at the front, which... Honestly, okay, that's not the worst excuse you could possibly have for leaving the king unguarded here. But they announced to tell everybody, oh, by the way, you're all fired. Fuck off. Leave your hat and gun. And so they put in their muskets and their swords and they give everything up and they all leave. Well, and that's the day that D'Artagnan shows up to get a job.
I feel like that's been my life when I try to get writing gigs. It's like, hey, can I apply for a job? Sorry, we're disbanding.
Sorry, we just pivoted the video. Fuck.
Zuckerberg? look up the pivot to video thing. Yeah. That is too much to go into. They throw down their swords. They don't throw down their muskets. For being musketeers, there's not a lot of musketing going on.
Yeah, I know. It's always funny to me.
There is a Batman weapon where Porthos pulls out, like, a triple dagger. He hits a button on his knife and it splits into three blades. It seems like that would be pretty impractical to, like, build.
Yeah.
But it's cool looking.
He only uses it once. Need to use it once.
He runs in... D'Artagnan runs into each of the three musketeers in turn and runs afoul of them in some way.
Yeah, this is all from the book. This is all classic stuff. What happens is three musketeers have refused to retire. That's Athos, Porthos, and Aramis. Rochefort has been told by Cardinal Richelieu to track them down, do whatever it takes. Those are the worst of the musketeers, aka the best. And Rochefort said, of course, I will look everywhere for them. They're literally all within a 2-minute walk of the building. In fact, one of them was literally in the building. So Kiefer Sutherland is literally in the building and D'Artagnan shows up and he's just like, hey, can I be a musketeer? He's like, no, they've disbanded. And D'Artagnan's like, oh, you're a jerk. Kiefer Sutherland's like, the fuck did I do? He's like, nothing. He's like, meh. And so Kiefer Sutherland's like, okay, fine. I'll challenge you to a fucking duel. Shut your mouth. And he's like, okay, fine. I'll see you at the thing at noon. And he's like, fine.
This is all from the book, by the way. Yeah.
They don't always happen the exact same way.
D'Artagnan is a young hothead, and the Three Musketeers are sort of his bosses.
I've actually never read the book, but I've seen a lot of adaptations of Three Musketeers. And
I have read the book, and it's thrilling. It's just such a delight.
In the movies that I've seen, usually what I recall is that when D'Artagnan leaves his home, someone like an uncle or something tells him that when you get there, fight as many duels as you can. It'll boost your cred.
Yeah, your street cred.
Yeah, so that's why he's challenging all these guys to duels, but they don't do that here, so he just looks like a piece of shit.
Yeah, this is
challenging all the duels for nothing.
We say this is from the literature, but this does not have the tone of Dumas at all. This is all very hip.
This is all very frothy,
light. 90s kind of action blockbuster.
A tone
movie.
I quite like, by the way, and it's not necessarily the worst approach to this material, but it is its own thing.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about the Three Musketeers, is that they can be updated to whatever the actual sort of action languages of the day.
Yeah.
It's that versatile a story. And we've taken so many action tropes from it that it's okay to update it. And I've seen a lot of Three Musketeers movies, and that are all slightly different in tone, and they're all pretty much delightful. Some of them are bad, some of them are good, but they all work.
Yeah, it's such a straightforward. Like, the structure is so sharp that it's actually hard to screw it up.
I didn't see the one with, was it Mila Jovovich played Milady?
The Paul W.S. Anderson version.
Yeah, I didn't see that one.
I did not care for that version. I've been meaning to rewatch it.
Like, steampunk, and they got, flying ships and shit.
I'm not opposed to that, but I just didn't think it worked. But, I've been meaning to rewatch that. I know some people really like that one.
Okay.
I don't hate Paul W.S. Anderson. I actually like some of his movies, but...
No, I think he's just fine.
I think he's made some real crap, but he's also made some stuff I really think is fun, even though it's stupid.
It's the kind of... It's like Stephen Sommers syndrome. It's stupid crap, but... come on, it's kind of fun.
real fast, he runs into Porthos, and he just he makes Porthos spill something, and he's like, "Hey, whoa, my fucking scarf, dude! I got this from the Queen of America." And D'Artagnan is like, "There's no Queen of America." And Porthos is like, "You duel?" He's like, "Okay, fine, duel. Sorry." And so then he runs into Aramis, who is running away because he was like macking on some dude's wife, and then Aramis falls on him and apologizes, and D'Artagnan's like, "You're an asshole." He's like, "I apologized." Mm. And he's like, "Well, yeah, duel." So fine. So he's got duels with all three of the Three Musketeers.
Kiefer Sutherland, you said he's the broody one, and Kiefer Sutherland is just doing his job. He's playing the broody guy. I don't think he's bringing a whole lot to Athos.
No, he's not. He gets the pathos, but it doesn't work.
Oliver Platt is, as always, bringing his A-game, because Oliver Platt is just one of the great comedic actors of his generation, frankly. Yeah. He is great in everything, and he is...
I've never seen a bad Oliver Platt performance. Never once.
He's been in bad movies.
Oh, lots of times, but he's always the best part.
I think, even though the film's not that great, I think his star performance was in a film called The Imposters, which he made with Stanley Tucci.
Parts of that movie have not aged well, but it's...
There's a lot of homophobia in it that doesn't play very well, but it's...
The overall...
Which didn't, even at the time, like a lot of critics picked up on that.
The overall madcap tone of that is really, really good, and he's very, very funny.
I've
never interviewed Oliver Platt, but I did run into him once.
Okay.
And I was actually right after I'd seen the movie Chef. I was at South by Southwest.
Okay.
And normally I don't do parties at those things, but I saw the movie Chef, and they promised at the party there would be Cubanos, and you cannot see the movie Chef and not want a sandwich. Uh-huh. You will want a sandwich after you see the movie Chef. So I was like, all right, I'll take the fucking sandwich. Fine. So I got the sandwich. Sandwich is great. And who happened to be there, like, getting a sandwich when I was, but Oliver Platt, who's in the movie as a food critic. And I actually told him, and I meant this, I really like him in that movie, because at the start of the movie, he seems like he's the asshole critic. And it seems like Jon Favreau had made a movie about how critics don't understand real art.
Mm.
But at the end of the movie, he makes a point that, like, no, Jon Favreau completely misinterpreted. He's like, I'm just telling it like it is. I want to like your food.
Yeah. And indeed, when he does something that impresses him, he says so. And
he's
indeed,
the first one.
He's the first one to say so. And he even offers to, like, co-fund this thing because he believes in him so much.
I like the portrayal of criticism in that movie quite a bit. And I was telling him, like, there aren't a lot of movies that I feel... like, have a character who's a critic who's actually treated well as a character with some sort of understanding of what goes into that. And I thought you did a great job. He was very nice. Mm. I don't know any beyond that. But I like meeting him because I'm a fan. I think Oliver Platt's a really great actor.
And he's the best part of this movie quite easily. Well, he and Tim Curry.
Tim Curry, come on.
And Rebecca De Mornay sashaying about in her elaborate gowns.
Yeah.
But then we have Charlie Sheen, who is bringing nothing.
No.
He has no energy. He has no character. He's just sort of flatly reading his lines. He quotes the Bible a couple times, which just to give you the idea that he's supposed to be the religious one with like Christian principles. But that's not part of his character, really.
No, Charlie Sheen.
He wanted so bad to just give a standee, like a cardboard standee of himself. So yeah, that's me, and he slips away.
Well, the story goes that when they were making this movie, most of the cast did like a solid 6-week boot camp of like horse riding and fencing and all the important stuff in order to sell it.
Yeah.
Charlie Sheen did not do that. He was making Hot Shots Part Deux, so he just showed up on the set.
Oh god.
Apparently, he hated horses. There's a reason why a lot of the times when Charlie Sheen is, like, sword fighting, he stops sword fighting and just punches a guy.
because he couldn't be bothered to do the sword fighting. He is sleepwalking through this damn thing.
He really is.
And D'Artagnan is Chris O'Donnell, and Chris O'Donnell's just sort of the young surfer dude.
His whole thing is he's supposed to be naive. He gets away with it. He's not great, but he's good at the physicality, and I think that's really important with D'Artagnan.
I was watching this with my wife, and she and I came to the conclusion that although he's a little too old for it at the time, Emilio Estevez would have made a good D'Artagnan, especially if this had been made like a decade before, like Repo Man years.
Yeah.
It was sort of like the young punk.
He would have been good at any of those roles, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
Honestly, he could be good Athos. He would have been a good Aramis. No one to be a better Porthos, but like he would have been a good Porthos.
Emilio Estevez, and I'll say this, he's been the butt of so many jokes. He was a punchline in a movie, A Night at the Roxbury.
Yeah.
It's like, we met a celebrity. It was Emilio Estevez. And that's supposed to say, like, kind of how pathetic those guys are. They were impressed that they met Emilio Estevez. the Mighty Ducks kind of torpedoed his career. It was a big moneymaker for him, but he lost a lot of credibility as an actor.
Yeah, he was seen as like kind of like a big deal actor for a bit there, and just but he was also one of those people who was so boyish that he wasn't really aging into his looks.
Yeah, that was part of
people
it.
People didn't know what to do. It's like Tobey Maguire syndrome. Like, people just don't know what to do with them now.
And that's affected generations of actors.
Yes. Winona Ryder was another one of those. She always looked young, and that kind of like made it difficult for together roles.
Sal Mineo back in the day, how he said he always looked like a kid, and Judy Garland.
Yeah, they tried to make her look young for so long that when she was finally like an adult, nobody bought her as an adult.
Because
they were trying to make her stay the Wizard of Oz actor for so long.
There's a problem with Mickey Rooney as well.
Yeah.
Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney.
So
that was an issue with Emilio Estevez.
You
go back to movies like Repo Man, you see that he has chops. And he's also a pretty good director as well.
He is, actually,
But... Stephen Herrick, like, both made and broke his career shortly after making The Three Musketeers. So he got to work with Sheen and Estevez. Brothers, in case you didn't know. They all meet at the same spot. There's gonna be a big sword fight, and lo and behold, there's a big sword fight.
Well, the Cardinal Richelieu's men show up, and so instead of fighting the Three Musketeers, he agrees to fight Cardinal Richelieu's men. There's this really funny bit, actually, where they all fight Cardinal Richelieu's men, and it's a pretty good sword fight. It's pretty good. I'm just gonna say it right now. I think the action work on this movie is solid. Amazing? No. Solid? Very much so. They all fight, and they've killed all the bad guys. And then the Three Musketeers are about ready to fuck off, and D'Artagnan's like, well, let me go with you. I wanted to be a musketeer, and you guys are the only ones left. And they're like, no, we're outlaws, and now you are too. And I'm like, we killed all of them. They didn't know I did that. Were they going to do forensic analysis on my rapier? No, it's fine. The only reason he ends up in any trouble whatsoever is that after the Three Musketeers leave, he rides off in another direction, sees 50 of Cardinal Richelieu's men, and decides to charge like an idiot. So he gets arrested. He ends up escaping from the prison. And while he is escaping, he sees Cardinal Richelieu conspiring with Milady, a femme fatale, played by Rebecca De Mornay, and they're conspiring
to archetypal femme fatale.
Oh yeah,
she's
kind of where the trope comes from.
1844,
really.
Dumas kind of invented it. It's a longer, more complex tradition, one of the archetypes.
A lot of the pulp femme fatale characters we see in a lot of our stories, it stems from Milady. They're conspiring with I think it's Lord Buckingham.
Yeah, I think so.
The whole thing is...
He doesn't have a big role in the movie.
They're conspiring to start a war with England and also kill the King of France so Cardinal Richelieu can take over. And so she has to take a contract to England, and only D'Artagnan knows what ship it's on. And so when he finds the Three Musketeers, when he escapes, they have to get there before her and stop her from conspiring against the king before the king can be assassinated on his birthday. It's all very clean. And I don't like it. I actually
want
prefer
it to be a little bit more complicated.
No, I prefer the original version. The original version of this actually wasn't about, there's a contract. No, the problem was everyone's fucking each other too much.
Yeah, everybody was having affairs, and they were trying to hide the affairs. And
the original version of this is actually a little bit more complicated. It's maybe to a fault, but it's fun. The idea is that the queen and the king are not romantically compatible, and the implication is the king is probably queer. I forget how clearly they say that. I've never read the book, but a lot of other versions of the movies, they go in that direction. So the queen has been having an affair with a British noble. She gives the British noble some of her jewelry as a token of her love. And Cardinal Richelieu knows of this. And so he tells the king, hey, when you have your birthday party, you should tell the queen to wear that jewelry you got her. And if she doesn't, you'll know that she hates you. And the king's like, what? That's weird, but okay, let's do this. I'm very pliable and easy to manipulate.
The king is a boy.
Yeah.
He's like a teenager.
Yeah.
And he's played by an Irish actor named Hugh O'Connor.
In this one, he is.
Who was the kid from Rawhead Rex.
Wow. I did not put that together. That's awesome. But in any case, so what happens is the Three Musketeers have to get to England and get the jewelry back so that the Queen cannot be slut-shamed in front of everybody and start an international incident. That is what the original Three Musketeers was about.
And it leads to my favorite scene in the Three Musketeers novel, where D'Artagnan has finally made it to Milady to get this piece of evidence. And I think she's at an opera. She's at a show. She's in public.
Something like that.
It's so desperate, though, it needs to happen right away. So, she ends up, reaching behind the curtain, and D'Artagnan only gets to hold her hand, doesn't even get to see her, but it's, the most romantic experience of his life, just taking this thing from her hand, holding her hand, just her hand, it's Thing from the Addams Family, for just a moment, and then leaving. It's he's completely consumed now with Milady. Yeah.
But they managed to get back in time and everything.
And Milady has a name, but that's her code name. They just call her Milady.
She has a bunch of different names. Yeah. Basically, she's married different people and she's killed all her husbands and everything. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. But Disney, perhaps because it was simpler this way, or perhaps because it was too sexy, Disney decided not to go that route. Decided to just have a whole thing. We have to stop Milady from giving a guy a contract. Although they took out the whole everyone sleeping around bit, they did leave in a scene about, and I'm quoting the film, wenching.
There's two incredibly, as the kids would say today, two very horny scenes in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
One is the scene where Chris O'Donnell has no pants and the camera looks right down Rebecca De Mornay's blouse. There's really lascivious camera shots.
This seductive scene with her and Chris O'Donnell.
And it's all
he doesn't know she's the spy.
And they're kind of fighting, but it's all really flirty and all half naked.
That one works.
Yeah, and the other one is the wenching scene, where each of the Three Musketeers gets to give their advice on how to pick up ladies and how to kiss and touch
ladies. We're talking about bar ladies who... It subtly implied that they're sex workers and this is all actually pretty easy and they're going about this all more complicated. But certainly they're very eager regardless. And so the whole thing is, Oliver Platt's let me tell you about the delicate art of what he calls wenching, which is pretty shitty way to put it. But his whole thing is, a quick joke and a smooch and make it a sexy smooch and you're great. And then Aramis is just yes, but if you say sexy words... they'll be more excited. And then Oliver Platt's pshaw with you. And so Aramis gives the lady a poem and the lady's just oh, that is a sexy poem. Here's your smooches. And he's that's great. And then D'Artagnan tries to do both things. He tries to do both things and he fails miserably. And he ends up instead getting drunk with Athos, who doesn't go in for the whole, oh, hi Luca. How you doing, buddy? You have strong opinions about Three Musketeers? My cat wants in on this.
Luca the cat just put his front feet on the table and tried to hit you.
He likes what he does is he'll sit next to me. He'll sit next to me when I'm sitting in my chair, and then he'll put his paws up on the table, and then he'll reach one paw up, almost he wants to high five me. And he just wants attention. He just wants, hey buddy, I love you. We'll play a little later, okay? We're doing a podcast. But anyway, he ends up getting drunk with Athos, who tells him a story which is totally not actually about Athos. But
definitely not.
Turns out there was a count who loved a lady once, but it turns out that she was an accused murderer, and he was so offended he had her executed, and he felt really bad about it. So yeah, love sucks. Don't do it, kid. And I'm the real message here is that Athos sucks. But
he's broody. Which makes him attractive.
Yeah. And of course, the twist is Milady was actually Athos's wife. Mm. Athos, there's a big fight on a boat. They fight some guys. Some of it's fun, some of it's not.
The pirate stuff was okay.
It's okay.
I love that Porthos is, he seems the most capable of the Musketeers as well.
Yeah.
He's the funniest, he's the most charismatic. They should have just called it Porthos the movie. Porthos and D'Artagnan.
He runs away with the whole fucking film is what he does. And there's a cute bit I like where he actually he's on the ship and a bunch of sailors come up to fight him. And then they see him, it's like, Porthos the pirate! And they just run. Yeah. And D'Artagnan's D'Artagnan's Porthos the pirate? It's like, what? I told you I traveled the world. What do you want from me? It's cute. I like it. I like that he's the comic relief, but he's actually capable. This is something that some movies forget to do. If you're going to have like an action hero character who's the funny one, they also need to have a reason to be there besides being the funny one. This is one of the reasons why I prefer the extended cut of The Two Towers to the theatrical cut, because the character of Gimli, played by John Rhys-Davies,
sort of a comic relief character.
Well, and here's the deal. He's a dwarf, and he says a lot of funny things because there's like a culture clash kind of thing. And in the first movie and the second movie, he also gets to kick a lot of ass. Everyone there is a warrior, right?
Yeah.
In the second movie, he kind of doesn't really.
Okay.
I mean, he's there in the final battle, but like he's mostly there for like short jokes. And, you know, Legolas is like, oh, can I get you a box? That kind of thing. Yeah. And he's just like, ah, I love eating. Like that kind of thing. And he's just, in the theatrical version, he's a comic relief character. He doesn't get anything to do. In the extended cut, Legolas and Gimli are having a running tally of who can kill the most orcs in the final battle.
Oh, that's in the movie. Yeah.
And in the extended cut, we find out Gimli won.
Oh, really?
And that redeems him! That basically says he was the tough one!
There was a gag because they have, like, war mammoths or some shit in that movie.
Well, you're thinking of Return of the King. That's one with mammoths, but...
Okay, yeah. I remember the elf character murdered an entire war mammoth. Like, somehow he killed it. And Gimli's joke was, that still counts as one kill. Like, it was this big impressive
thing. Well, they'd already done it in The Two Towers. They were continuing the gag in Return of the King. But yeah, in the extended cut of The Two Towers, you find out Gimli won. And I always thought that was a really, really great way to sort of just say, yeah, sorry we made you tell so many jokes this time and not do a lot. Like, you're going to be, here, you're cooler than Legolas.
Comparing this to a film that came after another Three Musketeers film, The Man in the Iron Mask.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which was a little bit more of a classed up joint. It was Leonardo DiCaprio hot off of Titanic, and he played the evil king and The Man in the Iron Mask. Spoiling the ending of The Man in the Iron Mask.
Well, it's spoiling the middle of the movie, anyway. It wasn't just after Titanic, it was right after Titanic. Titanic was still number one at the box office when Man in the Iron Mask premiered.
That's right.
And it came in like second or third. Like it's
still didn't be Titanic.
The brand new DiCaprio movie. No one cared.
But the Three Musketeers in that one were played by John Malkovich, Jeremy Irons, and Gerard Depardieu.
And D'Artagnan was played by Gabriel Byrne.
That's right.
And boy, is that a great cast.
Yeah,
for
seriously.
Anything.
And Gerard Depardieu plays Porthos in that one. And in that movie, they're a little older. Like
they're retired.
They're kind of not the action stars they used to be. So they're kind of like coming to terms with the fact that they just can't be the adventurers they once were, but they get to pull it out for one last adventure. But Porthos is considered, he's the comic relief character.
Yes, he is.
And he's kind of the pathetic character, and he doesn't get a lot. Like, he wins battles by luck. He's more like Falstaff by that point.
And, no, I agree, yeah.
And it is kind of a pity that the funny comic relief action star tends to tilt towards Falstaff more than Oliver Platt as Porthos.
Yeah, or Gimli, I would take, even as long as he focuses on the badass version. But yeah, exactly. Porthos is
like,
a great character.
I do like Falstaff. I figure he's an archetype for a reason.
Mm, but he's not a badass, is he?
No.
He's a tragic fool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The whole point is that he's not a badass. He's a lying coward who lies about his conquests.
Yeah. Porthos is a legit action hero, and he could have totally had a spinoff
Of this. I didn't see the Richard Lester version. Who played Porthos in that one?
It was Richard Chamberlain was Aramis, and Oliver Reed was Athos, and it was a French actor whose name I can't recall. Well, I'm going to find out. Hang on. Because actually, I was gonna bring this up. I was gonna might as well ask you now. What is your favorite version of The Three Musketeers as a movie?
Not this.
okay, fair enough.
That's a good question.
Yeah, because it's been done a million times. Yeah. There's a Gene Kelly version, which is very respectable. Let's see, who played Porthos? Porthos was... Oh, I was wrong. It was Frank Finlay. Who was English. He just did a pretty good French accent, I guess. Right. He was in the Laurence Olivier Othello. He was Iago. So, yeah, respectable actor. Mm. And he's good. He's actually quite good in it. But he's no Oliver Platt. Like, I will say that personally, I think the Richard Lester Three Musketeers is the best Three Musketeers.
That's from 73.
73. It was also much like Superman 2. They like kind of shot it as like a giant two-parter, but then they separated it into two different movies. So it's the Three Musketeers and the Four Musketeers. Four Musketeers is fine. Three Musketeers is great. It's got a great cast. The stunts are really, really good. The sword fighting is top-notch. It's got a great sense of place, wonderful production design, costumes, and even more so than this movie, it is horny as fuck. It is so unbelievably horny, like you wouldn't believe. And listen, and again, speaking of good casts, let's look at this cast. Michael York is D'Artagnan. Right. Oliver Reed is Athos. Frank Finlay is Porthos. Richard Chamberlain as Aramis. You've got Geraldine Chaplin as the Queen. You've got Charlton Heston as Cardinal Richelieu. You got Faye Dunaway as Milady. You got Christopher Lee as Count Rochefort. You've got Raquel Welch in there. You got Spike Milligan in there. You've got Roy Kinnear. You got Sybil Danning.
Sybil Danning.
Sybil Danning is in that fucking in the 70s.
She was like a teenager at that point.
Yeah. That's an amazing cast. That movie rules. And I've heard some people, funnily enough, by just sheer chance, I saw someone tweeting that they think this Disney version of Three Musketeers is the best one. I'm curious how many other ones you've seen. I'm not going to be judgmental. I just want to know what other ones you've seen. Because if you've seen the 73 version of the Disney version, I would be a little surprised if the Disney one is your personal favorite for reasons beyond nostalgia. Because the 73 version is amazing.
I've seen the 48 version when I was a kid.
Is that the Gene Kelly version?
That's the Gene Kelly version. That's with Van Heflin, Lana Turner, June Allison, Angela Lansbury, and Gene Kelly. The one I remember most fondly is when I saw in college. It was the silent version from 1921 with Douglas Fairbanks as
D'Artagnan.
I think D'Artagnan.
Okay,
let me look up the cast of this one.
Yeah,
Douglas Fairbanks played D'Artagnan. Other actors, Eugene Pallette played Aramis.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Wow. That would have been Aramis cool.
Played Aramis. Oh, a young Eugene Pallette.
Eugene Pallette, if you don't know the name.
Eugene, where's my breakfast Pallette?
Eugene Pallette became probably best known as like a character actor in like comedies in the 30s and 40s. And he was a big guy who talked like a fucking buzzsaw. You know?
He's wonderful.
Like, ah, everyone in here has got a... Like, that's kind of... So it's weird to think of him as like the action one. But that's cool. I really want to see that movie now. I can't believe I've never seen that one.
An actor named Walt Whitman played D'Artagnan's father, and I thought for a second, wait a minute.
Boy, would that have been the soul
thing? Walt Whitman was not in movies.
Maybe he was.
Maybe he lived longer than I thought. No, it's an actor named Walt Whitman.
Jesus Christ.
Anyway. Yeah, I remember really liking the silent version when I saw it in college. So
that's cool.
I'm going to be the snot and say the silent version is the best.
Perfectly fine. Anyway, but back to this one.
Walt Whitman died in like 1890.
Anyway, they arrest Lady Milady, and Kiefer Sutherland's like, "Hey, sorry about everything," and she's like, "Fuck you," and he's like, "Fair enough." And then she's about to be executed, and just as she's about to be executed, Kiefer Sutherland's like, "No, I can't live without your forgiveness. Can I make this all about me?" And she's like, "Fuck, God, you know what? Fuck it. Here's the whole plan. I don't care anymore." And she just jumps off a cliff, which apparently is the very first character in all of Disney history to kill themselves on camera.
Really?
I've heard. I can't think of another example.
There's got to be something.
To kill themselves.
I'm not to
fall and die.
I'm pretty sure I've seen, like, Donald hold a pistol to his head.
Yeah, but he survived.
Well, he's a cartoon duck. Of course he survived. But he still tried.
I don't know. For me, I was like, she jumped off a cliff. We don't see her fall. We don't see her splat. I'm like, she could have made it. Could have been a cliff dive. You know, she could be fine. Then again, I think the ending of The Wrestler is happy. So what the fuck do I know?
The most notable... they played suicide for a joke in Christopher Robin. And it just made me realize.
Right, they did
made
with Eeyore realize trying to kill himself,
that,
but he can't.
Yeah, like the true tragedy of Eeyore is that he's perpetually depressed that he can't die. Like the first time we see him, he's floating down a river and he's saying, "My latest suicide attempt didn't work again." It's like, holy shit, this is dark.
That movie is.
That is a twisted fucking movie.
That movie is weird and
it's
bad.
It's so bad.
Anyway.
It's so bad.
Anyway, they have to race back with the evidence and. You know, they get there just in time, and, you know, they fight a bunch of guys. The last fight's pretty cool. A lot of cool fighting, a lot of jumping around. Again, Chris O'Donnell, not an amazingly charismatic actor, but good, like, physical presence. He was a good... There's a reason they cast him as Robin. He could fight, he could jump around, he looks good doing it.
Yeah. And he's fine as sort of, like, the... the sexed up updated version of Robin that Joel Schumacher came up with.
Yeah. He's fine as Robin. For that version of Robin, not my favorite version of Robin, but that's a good Robin. He's fine with that.
Fine.
Yeah, it's not
for that kind of Batman film, he certainly fits.
He's what you needed. I forgot. Did you ever see that other Musketeer version? The Musketeer, directed by Peter Hyams?
It was one of those films that I saw pieces of, so not really.
This is a novel version of The Three Musketeers, because it was
Yen Woping, wasn't it? Didn't
I don't think it was Yen Woping. It was another, but basically what happened was Peter Hyams was like, hey, let's do a version of The Three Musketeers, but we're going to make... action sequences.
It's like a kung fu movie.
It was right after The Matrix. And so the idea was we're going to do all,
Yen Woping.
Yeah, stunt choreographer was Shin Shin Chong.
Okay, but a notable Hong Kong stunt choreographer.
Yeah, he was a Jet Li stunt double for a while. He worked on Once Upon a Time in China movies.
Okay.
Which is makes sense because they pretty much rip off one of the biggest action sequences from those movies in the
I knew it was Hong Kong talent in that movie.
Yeah. Anyway, it was not a hit.
Mm.
It didn't have a great cast, although Tim Roth played Rushmore, and that's actually a pretty good casting there. But the stunts are great. And if you just want to see a version of The Musketeer where the stunts are just like, wow, holy fucking shit, the fuck is... Whoa! Like jumping around on like beer barrels and doing like full splits while you're fighting and shit. Looks cool. Like, again, the cast is... The plot is... And there's a part where D'Artagnan's girlfriend... clearly dies, but that ending also clearly didn't test well, so even though her lips aren't moving and she's not moving, you can hear Mina Suvari say, I'm not dead, would you please kill the bad guy? And he's like, okay, great. So he runs after the bad guy with all the rage of someone whose girlfriend is dead, even though we literally know she's fine. Like, it doesn't work at all. It's so bad. But the stunts are amazing, so that's a neat version. I digress. So it's a big fight. D'Artagnan becomes the king. We haven't really talked about Tim Roth because Tim Roth just nails it.
Tim Curry.
We haven't talked about Tim Roth because he's not in it. We haven't talked about Tim Curry because Tim Curry is perfect.
Yeah.
He's everything he needs to be. Hmm. And I kept thinking about the dialogue he has in this movie and how it's not very good, but because he's saying it and because he's just like, I'm so powerful, I can just tip my hat at how evil I am constantly and no one can do a goddamn thing, and I'm making myself laugh. That is a fun character trait for a villain.
Tim Curry classed up every joint he was in. He wasn't getting a lot of A gigs throughout the 90s. He started showing up in stuff like McHale's Navy and Charlie's Angels and these.
Well, started doing a lot more
one
like,
of the scary movie movies.
He started doing more animated work. He was animated work. He was the bad guy in Fern Gully.
There was a Tales from the Crypt audio series.
What?
That they made at one point.
I have no memory of this.
In I think the early 2000s. And. Yeah, and they got like an all-star cast. There's a Most Dangerous Game where Gina Gershon is hunting Luke Perry. And Tim Curry is in one of them because of course he is. They got John Cusier to play the Crypt Keeper. And Tim Curry is the narrator, and it takes you until the end of the series to realize that he's playing a trunk. Like a footlocker. Like he's playing like a talking footlocker.
What?
Is that
the twist?
Well, it kind of. The idea is he's narrating the story and he talks about having, you know, he's best friends with the main character, and the main character is this poor abused girl who's constantly locked in a trunk and she grows up to be this sort of like twisted murderer because she's so like horrendously abused and she kills her parents. But, Tim Curry's like, oh, I miss her. I miss her so much. And you realize that he's the trunk that she was locked in. He's playing the voice
that's
of the trunk.
So weird.
And that's one of those things that you could only do in audio because there's no visual element to
it. Yeah. That's such a weird fucking thing.
Yeah. That one's really, I encourage you to look up the Tales from the Crypt audio drama. It's one of Tim Curry's like more notable roles from that era.
Also notable from that era, movie you're a huge fan of. He played Long John Silver in Muppet Treasure Island.
Yes, indeed. The best Treasure Island movie.
Okay. I'm not going to fight you on best Treasure Island movie. I'm not sure it's the best Muppet movie, but
it's my favorite Muppet movie. The Muppet movie is probably just better as cinema experience.
I actually think The Muppet Christmas Carol is where it peaked, but fair enough.
They came out right next to each other. It was the same creative team. We can have them both.
Yeah, they're good companion pieces. But there's a movie he did in the late 90s that people totally forget about. And I watched for the first time not that long ago. And I gotta say, not as bad as you might think. Adam's Family Reunion, where he played Gomez. Hmm. Raul Julia had passed away after he did the first two Addams Family movies, and they did a TV movie sequel starring Tim Curry as Gomez and Rebecca De Mornay as Morticia. Not Rebecca De Mornay. Daryl Hannah.
Daryl Hannah played Morticia.
I was thinking of Daryl Hannah.
Rebecca De Mornay could have played a good Morticia.
There's a lot of people who would be good in the Addams Family roles, and you're just waiting for that moment. We're like, God, please, someday.
Well, in the animated version, it was Charlize Theron and Oscar Isaac.
It would be great in live action.
It's like, just put them in live action.
It'd be amazing. Tim Curry plays Gomez, but he plays more of like the John Astin Gomez, a little bit more kooky, a little bit less sexy. But he's great, actually. It's a good cast in a dorky little TV movie. But if you like those other two movies,
and did you hear
don't avoid it. It's cute.
Did you hear who's going to play Gomez Adams in the TV series?
Is it Luis Guzman?
Luis Guzman is going to play Gomez Adams.
I'm totally down for that. I think that's really like cool.
I need to look up who's playing Morticia in that version. But I know Luis Guzman is playing Gomez.
Yeah, I think isn't the show just called Wednesday?
It's called Wednesday. It's the Wednesday Adam TV series, and it's evidently every episode is going to be
Catherine Zeta Jones. Is Morticia.
Well done.
Good job.
Catherine Zeta-Jones and Luis Guzman.
My God. I love it so much.
And I think it's the girl from Dumbo playing Wednesday.
I don't know. Jenna Ortega.
Okay. I guess it's not.
What would you know from? She was in Insidious Chapter 2.
I saw it.
You do. She was in The Babysitter Killer Queen.
I didn't see that.
She was on the TV series You, which is very hard to Google.
Same with the TV series C.
Anyway, we digress. But the movie ends.
Before we leave Tim Curry, there's a great bit where he gets his villain speech.
Yeah,
and he's being confronted by the king, who's sort of like this wilting flower character.
Yeah,
and he's like,
finally musters up his courage.
I've heard that some rumors about you, and he gets to have this great speech. Oh yes, I've heard the rumors as well. What is it that I'm plot? And he says the plot of the movie. I'm conspiring with this British man to assassinate you and take the throne. Yes, I've heard that. I've also heard that I can call birds out of the sky and I have magical powers.
Well, he goes on as well as, I'm also trying to steal your wife and I'm conspiring with the devil. And when he throws in the fake stuff at the end, I'm like, I just assumed that was happening
off
screen.
That was gonna happen anyway.
Like, oh, maybe he is. I don't know.
He's like, and there's this one wonderful bit where it's just like during a fencing tournament. So he's like holding a sword. He's like, yes, and I've heard some things. There's even more expedient ways to go about it. He's sort of like holding the sword. You think he's going to spin around and stab him right there. Great villain moment.
So amazing.
Tim Curry just handles it so well. That's just like classic cinema villain kind of stuff.
Anyway, it all ends with D'Artagnan becoming a musketeer. Everyone's like, great, D'Artagnan's a musketeer. And then Paul McGann shows up again. And D'Artagnan's like, well, still haven't settled this subplot. Everyone's like, no, we're all chased that one coded gay guy out of the film and just before the credits, and I'm like, cool, weird. He's wearing the makeup, he's playing very effeminate. It's just a weird note to end on.
What if he's the Scarlet Pimpernel?
Oh god,
crossover.
That would actually be cool. But I digress. but that's the Three Musketeers, and there was that hit song that is fine.
The score is petering off as the credits begin to roll, and we see the credit for the song right before the song begins to play. They're really proud of this damn thing.
Well, what they did is actually, and this is something I actually always like, when they know what the theme song is going to be before they did the score. They built the theme song around the score.
Like the song.
It's like the Titanic, you know. They did the score and they decided to add lyrics to it and make a song out of it. Mm. That's how we got the Titanic theme. But James Bond does this a lot when they have like their big song and they sort of write the score around it. So the score is always reminding you of the theme song and it gives everything a bit of personality. So this All for One and All for Love song is like peppered throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like it actually. I think the song is corny fluff.
Oh god, I hate the song so
much. I don't hate it, but it is corny fluff, and by god was it overplayed.
I hate Bryan Adams. Bryan Adams also did that song, Do You Really Love a Woman?
From Don Juan DeMarco.
Yeah. And And you're going to hate the song too once I tell you, and this is a bit of information that my wife gave me because she's a big REM fan, and and so she's followed the career of Michael Stipe very closely. The original version of that song that Bryan Adams usurped was going to be a duet between Michael Stipe and Tori Amos.
What?
In 1995. And they recorded one, and they decided not to use it. So that song has been locked in a vault thanks to Bryan fucking Adams.
So that's never come out.
It's never
that's
come out.
That's not on YouTube
somewhere. We don't know what that song sounds like. A love duet between Michael Stipe and Tori Amos in 1995.
And this is peak Tori Amos, by the way.
Yeah, this is when before Tori Amos went a little more mainstream and rock. Like, she's still, like, quirky piano Tori Amos.
Yeah, this is still Songs from a Quail Girl Hotel and Raspberry Swirl. Okay, that's fucking...
This is Under the Pink era,
wow,
Tori Amos.
That's a good era for Tori Amos. Yeah. He had, like, three or four amazing albums in the 90s.
Under the Pink is great, by the way. Yeah. The whole record. And, and this is, you know... right after Monster, so this is, you know, R.E.M. is still striding the world.
Okay, now I am pissed.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Then Bryan Adams came in with his big stupidness and wrote, "Do you ever really love a woman?"
I mean, it paid off. They clearly are happy with how it turned out.
Yeah, and the song was a hit, but...
That's how I feel about, I think it's... Is it... I remember one of the Pierce Brosnan Bonds. I can't remember if it was Tomorrow Never Dies or The World Is Not Enough. Mm. I think it's The World Is Not Enough.
There was Garbage did the song.
Okay, then I think it's Tomorrow Never Dies. Then where they do this thing sometimes where they ask a couple of different musicians to do a song and they decide which one they like best.
Oh, okay.
And there's one of those where they picked one, but then Katie Lang did a song that they didn't use.
Oh no!
And they use it over the closing credits, and it's such a oh, I want to. I think it's Tomorrow Never Does. I don't want to confirm that before we go here because listen to them back to back, and it's on Bond.
There have been some bad Bond songs recently. I don't even remember a lot.
It was Tomorrow Never Does. So you can hear the Sheryl Crow version, which is, and then you hear the Katie Lang version, which is pretty fucking good.
The only Daniel Craig Bond song I like is actually the one from Quantum of Solace.
Really? Most people hate that one.
Well, I don't like the vocals on it because it's Alicia Keys and Jack White.
They don't go together.
And they don't go together.
No, they've been
get a different vocalist, and that's a fun song.
Yeah, I either replace either of them, honestly. Get someone who goes with Jack White or get someone who goes with Alicia Keys, preferably the latter. You've got a better song. I agree with you.
Or just get one of them to do it. But I didn't like the Casino Royale. Like, what was it? Call Me by Your Name or something.
You Know
about
My Name.
You Know My Name.
Yeah.
And
that's okay.
The Adele song is.
You like Skyfall?
It's fine.
I like Skyfall. I don't hate it the way some people do. Not a huge fan of the Spectre song. It's too much of a downer, and I'm sorry, man. That song, the movie's enough of a downer as it is. You needed a counterpoint.
That's why I like Another Way to Die. It's like the upbeat one of the Daniel Craig film songs, even though the vocals suck.
I really hope after Daniel Craig is gone, we have an upbeat James Bond movie. It doesn't have to be chipper. But can it at the very least not be a slog? Because, Skyfall, I know why people love Skyfall, don't get me wrong. Skyfall is a dour movie.
Yeah.
Spectre is an exceptionally dour movie. They're supposed to be entertaining, right? You're supposed to actually have a good time.
We're still in the post 9/11 James Bond.
I had a good time with Casino Royale. That had some serious bits, too. Like, you can do them both. But anyway, I digress. But anyway, the Three Musketeers.
Three Musketeers. I hate Bryan Adams. That's where we were. I hate Rod Stewart.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure what he ever did to you.
Individually, he wrote bad songs that I hate.
I don't like. I like Rod Stewart fine.
And
Sting.
I like Sting as a person, and and I think there are some Police songs I like, but I like making fun of Sting because Police sell themselves as kind of this tough, quirky band, but they're like the wimpiest of the tough, quirky bands.
They're called the Police.
The Police.
How much
Proops has so many bits of making fun. It's like, oh, what are you going to call yourself? Like, to show that you're subverting authority as a rock band and are appealing to the rebellious instincts of the youth. Yeah. Oh, the Police, the opposite of what you should have called yourself.
Yeah, I'm going to start I'm going to start a band and call it Conservatives.
I'm going to give myself a really cool name, like Sting.
Yeah, Whitney Seibold and the Conservatives are playing with the Police tonight.
The Hall Monitors. Actually, Hall Monitors would be good.
That's a good
band name, yeah.
That's a good one. I like that one. That's funny.
The Police. We got Sting, Bryan Adams, and Ron Stewart. It's just this perfect suck quake. You know? Of bad music that I hate. So, I heard it a lot and when it came out in 1993, so I just did not like it.
That's
and hearing it again, all of the anger and all the bile just started coming back.
But as a movie, like, we've talked it to death. Overall, as a film, how is this Three Musketeers to you?
It's light and passable. It's too light for its own good. Oliver Platt and Tim Curry are the only things that have personality in this.
Yeah.
You cast Charlie Sheen and he's not a kook. What are you doing?
Yeah.
You cast
I guess he had done Hot Shots already. People knew it was
He can do something with a lot more broadly than he did. He didn't do anything in this movie.
There was a period where people didn't seem to know he was a kook. And by this point, we'd figured it out. You're right. It's absurd.
You cast Kiefer Sutherland, who can do dark roles. He's played like vampires and stuff already at this point in his career. I understand he's supposed to be the dark one. He's played villains a lot in his movies. He played the heavy a lot. This was his chance to do something a little bit different or a little bit more personality or bring a little bit more intensity to it. Mm. But he didn't. He was clearly holding back.
Well, his character's a little underwritten.
Stephen Herrick is a weird director, and I think he was trying to do something a little bit more mainstream with this.
Yeah.
And he succeeded, and that's disappointing that he was able to do something a little bit more acceptable. I want the
critters. Almost like Guy Ritchie's Aladdin. You watch that Aladdin movie, you'd never guess that Guy Ritchie directed it.
I want the guy with the dark sense of humor. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is an odd film.
Very strange. We take it for granted now, but that's a tough pitch, that movie.
It's about two surfer dudes who travel through time to gather historical figures just so they can pass a history report. That's a weird premise.
It's a tough sell.
How did that one catch on? Yeah. And then they do
There's no stars in it. It's like, fucking weird.
Then they do a sequel, and the sequel's even more daring because they abandon the premise. There's no time travel. Well, there's some time travel.
A little, but like, but it's mostly going to hell.
It's about going to heaven and hell.
It's so weird.
Those are...
Bless them. Both movies are great.
Yeah, and they did Face the Music, and that's like a nostalgia trip.
Yeah, but, it's too cheap for its own good, but the story's nice.
It's fine.
It's a nice little send-off.
Alex Winter came back, and Alex Winter just brought it.
He was good. Yeah. I was a little worried that like, oh, he hasn't acted in a while. He was great.
Yeah,
he was a delight. And you can tell that Keanu Reeves was enjoying being like, take. Keanu was cheating as a vacation. I just get to chill out and have fun. Thank God.
He showed up, and he was there to it, but... I mean, it just really highlight. Oh wait, Keanu Reeves is not that great an actor.
He's got limited range.
You can do Ted again, yeah. Then why aren't you doing it? Like, be excellent to each other. Oh yeah, and party on, dudes. No, say it the way you used to say it. Say it the first way. That's why you wrote it that way.
No, it's fine.
Stephen Herrick, who made Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, is capable of doing something kind of quirky and weird, and I feel like he was holding himself back, and it feels like a Disney production as a result. It feels really edgeless. There's not a lot of sex or violence. The swashbuckling is acceptable, but it's not better exciting.
It's better than a lot of stuff we get now. Action-wise, everything's chopped to hell. It's hard to follow.
Yeah, and it made me realize that I've seen so many action films, and I never feel excitement when I'm watching these movies. Somebody must somewhere. I mean, but, there's so many fight scenes that are just, okay, cut this out. We don't need action in action movies because they're never going to, unless you're going to do something really extraordinary, unless you're going to bring me, Mission Impossible Fallout or Mad Max Fury Road or do something incredibly extraordinary with the action, I don't care. Because the movie just stops. There's a lot of movement and then it kind of picks up afterwards.
A lot of my favorite action movies, the ones that really feel impactful, are the ones that actually don't have a lot of action. Mm-hmm. But when they do, it feels like, oh shit, what just fucking happened? Like a good example of this is a movie that... it's hard to recommend in some ways, but Rob Roy with Liam Neeson.
Where there's like two sword fights.
There's one chase, but it's actually done to like kind of dour music. So it's more moody than it is exciting.
And he gets away by hiding inside a cow carcass. Well, it's like really gross.
There's this bit where Liam Neeson is like, they've got like, he's like been arrested and he's got like a noose around his neck to prevent him from, getting away. And when they're jumping, when they're riding over a bridge, he jumps off the horse over the bridge and is hanging himself in order to escape. And the only thing is they need him alive. So they have to cut the rope and he just swims away. And I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ. Holy shit. And then that movie ends and I'm dead serious. 100%. Again, there's like 2.5 action sequences in this movie. Rob Roy, the Liam Neeson movie, ends with the single greatest sword fight in movie history. Number one. And I'm not kidding. It's fucking phenomenal how well thought out that thing is. It's so great. Everything fits their character. There's giant stakes. Tim Roth is evil as fuck. It's such a good fucking ending.
Yeah, there's...
But, like, it's only a couple of things, but it feels like it really means something when those action sequences come up.
It either has to mean something, you have to do it kind of sparingly, or, do something really extraordinary. Really, like,
Jackie Chan at his best.
Or and even Jet Li, any Hong Kong movie of the 1970s, kinda. I remember the sword fight from that really forgettable early 2000s version of The Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of Dumas.
Jim Caviezel and Guy Pearce fighting amongst a bunch of reeds or something.
No, it's at the beginning of the movie when they're first having it out, because they're both drunk and they're just trashing shit.
Oh, okay.
Like, they're not really hitting each other and it's really clumsy, and that's actually really exciting because you don't know who's going to get hit.
Okay.
They're not just both unstoppable action badasses.
Yeah. That works.
On the other side of that coin is Duel of the Fates. Impeccably choreographed, but who cares? Nothing's going on in that scene.
And we're watching a ballet. We're not really watching a fight. Yeah.
Which is fine. That's what a lot of Hong Kong movies are as well. I don't really care who wins the fight. More a dance than anything.
I saw this weird video on YouTube that was like an updated version of the fight between Darth Vader and Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars A New Hope.
Hmm.
Which, if you'll recall, is a guy who can barely move because he's disabled and in a robot suit, and an old man. And they're fighting, and their fighting is inspired by samurai movies.
Yeah.
And this video decided to use, like, deepfake technology and, like, some, like, stunt people or whatever to make the action choreography like it is in The Phantom Menace, all jumping around and wild and crazy. Mm. And I'm like, no.
that's not exciting.
It's an exercise, I guess, if you want to, like, practice editing and using this tech. But it's actually, it's not more exciting. It's just more elaborate, and it's not the same thing.
Mm.
But B, and I just think that completely wild, superhuman version of the lightsaber duels. Because, like, we see in, like, Empire and Return of the Jedi, occasionally they'll, like, grab something from across the room and try to hit each other with it, like, with the Force. But it's sparing.
Mm.
We're not using it constantly. We're not trying to do something that is outside the realm of the audience's understanding.
It still feels, like, special and kind of exciting.
Yeah. Gravity matters. Yeah. That kind of shit. And there's something about the lot of the sword fights and the prequels that just feels elaborate for its own sake.
Mm.
It feels like we're trying to show off to the audience, and it's not actually what the characters would need to do.
Mm.
You have a laser sword. If you touch each other with them, you win. Mm. So fighting in a more samurai mode, where samurais don't go cling clang,
it's a single blow. Maybe there's one block.
Yeah. Maybe.
But the whole point is, it's like a gunfight. You're only supposed to need one stroke.
Yeah, you're trying to win, which is why most of, like, the most badass samurai movies don't have a lot of duels between just two people, because that fight is over in a second.
The best sword fight in cinema history, I still hold, is from Sanjuro.
The ending of Sanjuro, which they had to invent a new sword fighting move to do, by the way, is, I'm not going to ruin it for you, it's fucking amazing, and it is kind of the whole point of what I'm talking about.
It's long, just watch it.
It's really fucking cool, and that whole movie's amazing. But, like, most of, like, the great action movie samurai films are about one guy fighting a whole fucking army.
Yeah.
Because every time he hits someone with a sword, that person is fucking dead.
Mm.
Or at the very least, they're not getting up anytime soon.
Yeah.
So that's basically it. And that's kind of the same thing with a lightsaber. So,
I feel like...
The whole point is to end the fucking fight.
I feel like... The Three Musketeers was in this weird sort of tipping point in action cinema, because this was, like, the early 90s.
Yeah, a lot of that Hong Kong choreography hadn't really come to America yet.
There wasn't a lot of Hong Kong choreography yet. It was all just sort of, like, fencing and rapiers. But they didn't have sort of actors who had the chops to really do it, so there's a lot of edits to hide the fact. A lot of it's really kind of awkward. They're really trying, but they're not working with a lot in The Three Musketeers. But this is before sort of the unbinding of special effects, so they couldn't be replaced with CGI avatars anymore. And so it wasn't classical, and it wasn't overstuffed yet, and it wasn't really great. It felt kind of drab.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I like the Richard Lester version, which has a lot of great sword fights in it. Some of them, and what I like is that every single character in that movie sword fights differently.
Mm.
Most of them are trying really hard not to get hit with the sword. So you're not seeing a lot of like up close fighting. They're trying to keep everyone at as much of a distance as possible. Mm. Oliver Reed is constantly trying to use like his coat to distract, like to like pull people away, yeah, and like scarred his arm and shit. D'Artagnan is of course the young crazy one who doesn't like give a care if he lives or dies because he doesn't really think about consequence yet. So he's doing all the acrobatic wild shit. And like it works and it's so much more effective than this, but I digress. But yeah, rewatching The Three Musketeers, I gotta admit, I like this version. I think it is...
Right.
It's mainstream, and there's no denying that. But I actually think if you were gonna, like... What's, like, the ne plus ultra, like, most, like, mainstream, here's, like, affable American action movie from the 90s?
Mm.
This is a good example of it. This is all-star. Mostly, the cast is here to, like, promote... Here to be on a poster.
Hmm.
You got Oliver Platt, so you win. You got Tim Curry, so you win. The action is fine. It's not entirely disrespectful to the source material. It's not like we're trying to make it completely nuts or bizarre.
Yeah.
It's a pretty straightforward Three Musketeers. They change a few things, but it's mostly the same. It works. Honestly, I think this movie works fine. Is it an all-time classic? No, but I get why people really, really like it. And I think it's a fun watch. I like this one fine.
If you're going to go for a swashbuckling, sword-swinging epic with a really sexy cast that is actually really, really good, go with Martin Campbell's The Mask of Zorro from 4 years after this.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Agreed.
Yes, they did cast Anthony Hopkins as a Latino character.
I think he's Spanish, actually. I think it was a colonialist, I believe, is the idea.
Oh, yeah, okay. I guess that
Antonio Banderas, on the other hand, is not Mexican. So, like, there's that. But, like, yeah, that's... But I digress. Mm. But I know the way that...
Kevin Zeta-Jones is Welsh,
The casting of that movie is controversial. And yes, it is. That's just true. And if that completely turns you off from that movie... Fair.
That's fine, but
totally fair. But it's got amazing stunts in it. And everyone's really charming.
Yeah. Well, a good sort of superhero origin story. It's told really well.
Yeah. Again, I'm not making excuses for it, but every other element of the movie works, and I think that's why some people really, really enjoy it a lot.
Yeah. And oh gosh, it so many young bisexuals came of age to that movie.
Oh, yeah.
Between that one and Desperado, Antonio Banderas has a lot.
Antonio. Thanks for being you, man.
Yeah.
My God. Whew. Anyway, I digress.
I've heard a lot of people say, I'm straight but desperado.
Yeah. But anyway, that is it for Critically Reclaimed this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back next week, and our new poll, which will be available at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We're going to stick with the 90s, and we're going to look at 90s dramas on Netflix. The pickings were a little slim, but we're able to find some stuff. Here's what we got here. We've got Dances with Wolves, the film that won Best Picture instead of Goodfellas. Which is pretty much the only way people know it.
3-hour post-Civil War epic directed by Kevin Costner.
Yep. We've got Howard's End, starring Emma Thompson and Anthony Hopkins, which is about a house.
It's called Howard's End. Yeah,
I saw this one when it came out, and I was a little kid, and I completely tuned it out. I don't remember almost anything about it. My Girl, a pretty quintessential coming of age drama from the 90s, starring Anna Chlumsky, the bees.
That's right. It has the same ending as The Wicker Man. I know how. I'm so sorry.
I'm so mad at you right now. And then lastly, the romance Love Jones, which is, very respectable movie and just doesn't get talked about a lot very often. Mm. So those are all available. We will review whichever one our patrons vote for. So please head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork to vote. It only takes $1 a month to vote. And you also get our Batman podcast, our weekly Batman podcast, for just $1 a month. And then we have at our $5 tier, we're reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. Our $10 tier, we're reviewing every single episode of Star Trek every week. I mean, not every one every week. We're going through it weekly. And we got commentary tracks on the higher tiers. We got online hangouts, the whole shebang. Very special thank you to all of our patrons, without whom we would have might not have watched this movie. We might have done something else, but instead you voted for this. And but thank you so much for keeping our shows going. We wouldn't exist without you. Thank you. Very big, very big shout out. And to everyone else, if you can't afford to join the Patreon,
Patreon.
I'm tired. If you can't afford to join the Patreon, we totally get it. It's so hard right now. But you know, there are other ways to help out. Please subscribe if you haven't already. Please leave us a review. Wherever you find us, that helps us find more listeners. So places like Apple Podcasts, that there's like engagement. It's weird that that's a thing, but it is.
That's the way they've decided how to gauge the popularity of these things. And give us a thumbs up, it pushes us up the list in the algorithm.
We're also on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
We have a podcast called We've Got Mail, where we read our listeners' email every single week. Well, we read the email they send us. We don't like hack into their emails. But
we're reading your emails every week.
People send us emails, they ask us questions, they take us to task when they disagree with us. They ask for recommendations, they ask us how things work in the industry and stuff like that. So if you want to write in, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box for those who like to send snail mail, and some people have also been kind and like have sent us trinkets and things, and thank you very, very much. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And I guess that's it. So thank you, everybody, once again, for listening to Critically Reclaimed. We'll be back next week with stuff. And until then, the podcast is over. Listen to something else for a while.